Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Susan Thompson, a host on New Books in African Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Will Rollison of Brunel University. He is a senior lecturer of anthropology. He's written a fascinating book titled Motorbike People, Power and Politics on Rwandan Streets, published in 2020 by Lexington Books. Will's book is an ethnography of taxi moto drivers in Kigali, Rwanda's capital city. Not only is his book a rich account of the everyday lives of motorcyclists, known in Kinyarwanda as motari, it is also an anthropological challenge to the concept of power and its relationship to culture. He argues that the concept of power is too expansive, too all-encompassing to provide explanations of how power operates in a given culture. Will finds that there is a dearth of understanding in the social sciences about the concept of power, leading to a conceptual inability to engage in questions of justice and make common cause with the oppressed. Will, I want to welcome you today. I'm super keen to learn from you. I want to start with the researcher as an instrument of knowledge. I'm always curious about how people do the work they do. So you write about this in the preface of your book. Who are you and what made you an anthropologist?
Well, a whole lot of accidents, really. I came out of school not having a very clear idea about what I wanted to do with myself. Having studied, because in the UK, you end up at school studying only three or four different subjects. So I'd studied, I think, English literature and fine art and politics and something else, which I can't remember what it was now. And I'd done best politics. And so I thought, oh, I'll go and read politics at university, and duly went to do that. So I went to the LSE, the London School of Economics, to read political science, but quickly found I couldn't do the maths. There was a lot more maths than I'd expected, and it was too much for me. And at the same time, I was taking as an elective an anthropology module, which was taught by Maurice Bloch, which was absolutely fascinating. And so at the end of my first year, much to the horror of the politics department, who thought that was very much a move down in the world, I switched over to anthropology. And then, yeah, I enjoyed it so much that I never left university, really. Never worked out what else I was going to do with myself. And so here I am.
I love that story. I'm a political scientist by training, and I have anthropology envy. So it's so interesting in the UK that it's a step down, quote unquote. I think that's great. But you don't seem self-conscious about it, so that's good.
No, I mean, I would never have made it as a political scientist. I wasn't cut out for it. It was dreadful.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Can you tell us how you prepared to study Rwanda? So Rwanda, of course, you know, is a contentious space, sometimes hard to do research depending on whom you ask. And so can you say more about, you know, the anthropology's primary tool field work?
Well, by comparison with a lot of the American grad students that I met while I was in Kigali, I was very poorly prepared in many ways. Mm-hmm. It wasn't my first research project. I mean, I did my PhD fieldwork in Papua New Guinea,
right?
Which in lots of ways is, although in many respects, it's more remote and places are more difficult to reach and the infrastructures and things are not as good, is a much, much, much easier place to work. It's socially easier. The language that I had to speak to get by there was much, much, much easier and all the rest of it. Once I decided to go to Rwanda then, I was then already working as a lecturer.
Sure.
So the opportunities for preparation are actually relatively limited compared to what you get in a PhD, right? So I arrived in Rwanda without really having a grip on the language, without all that many contacts. I mean, I did have obviously contacts with colleagues at this end. And very fortunately, one of our PhD students was actually working in Byumba in the north of the country. When I was in the field, and she was also very helpful. But it was a very, very, very steep learning curve, partly because Kinyarwanda is a horrible language to learn. I mean, I don't mind saying that. It was a very, very, very steep learning curve, and of course, a very, very different context to working in Papua New Guinea. So in lots of respects, if I could have my time over again, going to the country again, spending an extra year preparing for the research would be a really, really valuable thing to do. Does that answer your question?
I feel like you offered two really important things that listeners can think about. One is language learning, and, you know, that circles us back to political science, field work, quote unquote, in political science. You know, you're an expert in 2 weeks. And I appreciate your humility about, you know, the language was difficult. I think it's fair to say it's a horrible language to learn just because of the intonation and the way that it's a felt language in some ways. I know for myself, I think I spent, I can't remember now, but like 3.5-4 years preparing for my PhD field work. And you make an important point. That's the second point, I think. Fieldwork as a faculty member is quite a different set of restraints. So I appreciated your comment. But you said something also really interesting that I've struggled with. I worked in Rwanda for a long time, almost 15 years, and then I moved my project to Kenya and South Africa. I now work with refugee women in those two settings, and I found sort of the culture of surveillance and the challenge of the language and people's general sort of, I'm going to say disregard, that might not be the right word, but disregard for white foreign researchers to follow me into my next field. So when you said that some of Papua New Guinea followed you into Rwanda, I thought that was a really interesting thing to reflect upon, particularly when we think of researchers as instruments of knowledge. So that's another question I have for you. You spoke in your preface and throughout the book, you had your family with you, including a young daughter. What was your daily work like working with Motari, trying to spend time with your family and so on in a foreign culture?
Insanely stressful. Everybody was very, very, very understanding. I mean, luckily, my wife, who's an incredibly patient woman, is also an anthropologist.
Oh, great.
She's a Bolivian specialist. So she had a pretty good idea of what to expect, but the being around children was actually something which was, I don't think either of us had expected it to be as difficult as it actually was. And it gives you a real insight into the differences, the cultural differences in terms of the way people handle children, expect to handle children, and the infrastructures for children. I mean, just very simply, the part of Kigali we were living in, there weren't very many surface roads. And, you know, if you're used to pushing a kid around in a pushchair, then all of a sudden you can't. And so those things at a very practical level are very, very difficult, quite apart from the fact that, the neighbors were very curious and we were both kind of used to the lack of privacy that you have doing ethnographic work. But when you're also not sleeping and you're trying to look after a one-year-old, that is a little bit extra stressful, I guess.
It's so interesting that you say that because, of course, having children too in a different culture reminds you of the value that different societies place on child rearing. And was there any sort of gendered things with you being a hands-on dad in the way you describe in the book?
I mean, a lot of the sort of gendered problems, I guess, or not that or problems, but gendered
differences,
issues yeah. that we had, differences. Well, things which, of course, become problems in the context of your sort of personal life. A lot of it was around drinking culture.
Oh, interesting.
So the way in which, you know, I have to go back for bath time or I have to go back for bedtime isn't an excuse. That anybody will, because gender roles are different and because the men I was dealing with, I mean, a lot of the men I was dealing with, of course, were single themselves or were relatively young or were migrants who didn't have their families with them. Even the senior people who were family men that I was talking to, you know, the men were not expecting to be involved with young families in the way that I was. So that did produce, you know, that does produce certain kinds of challenges, obviously, when you're trying to run a household which doesn't run in the way that anybody else that you're dealing with expects. So again, I had to send, you know, texts late at night saying, you know, we're going to another bar now. I'm really sorry, but I'm not going to be home as I said I would be. So I say I'm blessed with an enormously patient and understanding wife.
We should all be so lucky. I think you said something really yeah. important, though. My partner is also very patient, so I feel lucky about that. The way that how people perceive you is not something you can actually always control. Control might be the wrong word, but how you are perceived as an individual in the field, quote unquote, changes based on age and gender and nationality and all these sorts of things. And that I just wanted to ask one more question before we move to your fascinating book. How do you, in the context of a foreign culture, make sense of or interpret or even verify what people tell us? And I'm thinking here of Leanne Fuji's work. I don't know if you've read it on her field work in Rwanda, where she has this article titled Truth in Lies. And of course, it's a double entendre. There's a presumption of lying, but also what people tell you is sort of what is laid bare before you. How did you work through your ethnographic materials to produce a book of this quality?
Well, I think, I think there's two things to say about this. I mean, the first one was that getting around, because I mean, it's something that I talk about a lot in the book,
yes.
is what's essentially the difference between the way I would expect people's speech to have a relationship with what I would call the truth
mm-hmm.
and the way that my interlocutors thought about that relationship. Now, that's, of course, something which has been noted, especially in Rwanda, quite a bit. And it goes all the way back to the sort of very early studies, like Mackay's studies of Rwanda about truth. Now, it took me quite a long time to get to grips with what was happening. And with what I could take to be, let's say, reliable information, which I would call factual, and what it was that people were doing in the field. Now, that was really frustrating to start with. And this is part, I suppose, of me carrying Papua New Guinea with me. Because if you ask a Papua New Guinean a question about something, on the whole, they'll tell you. And they'll tell you in a loud voice. And then people will fight about it and they'll argue. And occasionally, you find that people are trying to manipulate the truth, if you like, to mislead you. But it's not something that I found happening very much in the place I was working. So I came without really grasping. I mean, having read about language use in Rwanda, but without really being able to imagine what that was like, and getting blindsided by it. Really very seriously blindsided by it and finding that actually personally, at a personal level, extremely depressing and extremely distressing in lots of ways. And of course, it makes it very, very difficult to work. So there was that sort of practical aspect to it. But in terms of the interpretation and the projection of a book, I suppose that my strategy really has been to assume in lots of ways that whatever it is that I'm told is true for some purpose. I suppose I would characterize it as being like that. So when somebody tells you something, I mean, it's quite likely that the sorts of things that strangers in Rwanda tell you are veiling something in some way. But it's also probably the case, I found, or I worked on the basis that it's probably the case that the way in which they're controlling what they say has a purpose to it. So even if they're not telling you what I would call the truth, they are telling you something interesting. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that answer. I think you're sort of talking about the difficulty of interpretation as a fieldwork act or a writing act, but also the sort of the disciplinary epistemological realm of interpretation, which of course is something you get into in the introduction to the book. You talk about the difference between an interpretive and a functional question, which is something I want to get to. But before that, I just want to tell our listeners, because the presumption is, as you know, they haven't read the book. Will has a 5 substantive chapter book plus an intro and a conclusion, so 7 full chapters. And in my reading, it's more than a case study about the subculture of cooperative associations of, you know, motari, moto taxi drivers in contemporary Rwanda. It's also very clearly a critique of how social scientists approach questions of power. So anyone listening who's keen to understand sort of anthropological concepts of power, social science concepts of power, will find the book really useful. And I think one thing that I found most fascinating when I was reading it is that you make this, you know, sometimes explicit, often subtle call to action to ask social sciences to sort of stand up or rise up to meet the political challenges of a swiftly changing world. And this last point was so interesting because it felt activist. It felt like a call to action, which of course seems to me to be against the slow, prodding sort of work of scholarship, how we produce scholarship. So before we get into all of that, can you summarize your argument in your own words? Because of course we both know as writers, what you write and how people perceive what you write are often quite different.
Okay. Well, in terms of the argument about power, what I'm trying to say, and whether I succeed, as you say, what you write and what you've tried to write aren't necessarily the same thing. What I'm trying to say is essentially that in my reading, which is also, that's a whole nother issue, but in my reading of social scientific theories of power, one thing is very, very, very obvious, and that's that any theory of power is also necessarily a theory of what a human being is. So one way of thinking about it is that power, as a notion of how human beings are made to do something, implies that human beings, as political entities, as subjects, however you want to talk about them, have certain places where they engage with that power. I mean, to give a sort of contemporary analogy, it's a little bit like the way that a virus binds to a cell, right? I mean, the cell and the virus have to have certain features that allow them to bind to one another. Now, that means that if you theorize power, straight away you theorize human being. So to use examples that I sort of touch on in the book. I mean, if you think about the way that power gets theorized in French post-structuralism, so in the work of people like Michel Foucault, power takes a linguistic form, and it's basically about language and what people say and what they're capable, therefore, of imagining and building into their lives, which also implies that you have to think about people primarily as subjects in language. Now, correspondingly, if you think about power in a different way, then your person becomes different. So the sort of critical target, I suppose, of the book, critical target is perhaps the wrong word, but the person that I'm in dialogue with in the book is very much James Scott.
Yes.
Whose theory of power and of people is neo-Marxist via a reading of Gramsci and all the rest of it, but is in some ways much more sort of practical and concrete and humanistic than Foucault's. I mean, the people in his theories who are subject to power you have to imagine them as people who have feelings and are capable of being humiliated and put down and made to feel resentful and so on, very much as sort of every man or every person characters. So they're these sort of generalized human subjects. Now, that's very useful. This sort of generalized theory of power is very, very useful to my mind if you want to make big political statements that, or if you want to, and the sort of term I use in the book is if you want to make common cause with people.
Right.
I mean, if your objective is compassion, right, you have to be able to imagine these other people as being inherently similar to you. You get these theories of power then, and each of these theories of power constitutes the sort of person that that power works on. And I think it's fair to say that in Rwandan studies, and indeed in social science probably more generally, if people aren't thinking very carefully about power, and certainly if they aren't deliberately using, let's say, a Foucauldian perspective on power, then you tend to get these notions of power which depend on fairly generalized human subjects. Now, that's fine, but it does represent a choice. Because anthropologists know and have known for a long time and have been arguing since, I don't know, goodness only knows when, that one of the things which is really strongly cross-culturally variable and makes different social systems and makes different cultures and ways of life distinctive is exactly the way they imagine human people.
Right.
Which means that if you want to understand personhood in a culturally specific way, you can't be applying these generalized theories of power, because the theory of power brings its own theory of personhood with it, which is going to overwrite whatever local theory local people are dealing with. So what I'm arguing essentially is that, I mean, I this is why I say that describing Scott as a critical target isn't quite right, because I've got a huge amount of time for Scott. I mean, I think he's a wonderful theorist, and I make a lot of use of his work. But there's a fork in the road, if you like, where either you can go the whole anthropological, you know, the full anthropological Monty into theories of personhood, into the ways in which people imagine themselves and act towards one another in culturally distinctive ways, or you can do power. And what I'm asking, I guess, is what would it be like if you did theories of power on the basis of local theories of personhood? Now, if you do that, your ability to have common cause, your ability to have compassion, gets really seriously eroded. You can't do that anymore because the people you're dealing with are by definition not similar to you. So there's that choice. And what I've tried to do through the book, I suppose, is to highlight why the choice matters. I'm pursuing the choice which is about specific versions of personhood. So what I'm trying to do is to sketch out what I think the people I was working with in Rwanda, the way I think they thought about relationships that we would gloss loosely as being power, right? And how that worked in terms of the way they imagined themselves as persons and the way they dealt with they dealt with one another and with truth and all these sorts of issues. What I'm trying to do is to highlight how that choice operates and what difference it would make to pursue that sort of second option, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. It was really great to listen to you, because I do think that's what I found so fascinating about your book, so rich, is this but this centering of Rwandan conceptions of personhood through Motari. So perhaps we can pivot to that. So can you describe, you know, your field site? Because, you know, you don't have a field site in the traditional sense. You're dealing with a group of people who are mobile and are quite different as a common sample. And then, of course, you begin to think about the relationships that form their existence, like a subculture of personhood and power, which I thought was and just to back up a little bit, the relationship between livelihoods and personhood, I thought that was really interesting as well. So could you talk to us about your field site, quote unquote, the Motari with whom you spent a lot of time. You, of course, have the story of John Baptiste, which might be interesting to talk about at this stage.
Right. Yeah, well, I got into studying these motorcyclists really quite by accident, mm-hmm. As so many things happen. I mean, what I was interested in when I arrived in Rwanda was talking to migrants from rural areas, especially in the context of, I mean, there's a huge program for the almost total redevelopment of Kigali. I mean, whether it's really going to happen in the form the government imagines it is a different question. There's a sort of huge reimagining of the city going on as a sort of modern metropolis. And I was interested in that. And the problem that I very much had with all of the other difficulties of suddenly moving from a small island in Papua New Guinea to a city and moving to Rwanda and all the rest of it was being able to get hold of these migrants because they're all over the place. And they don't constitute a sort of field that you can get hold of in a sort of coherent way. So I was talking to the people that I knew and following up with various people, and they suggested that I talk to motorcyclists because the friends that I had, who were mostly relatively well-to-do, educated young men, were of the opinion that all motorcyclists were migrants from rural Rwanda, which is actually not true,
right,
as it happens. But it was a sort of opening. And they said, why don't you talk to these guys? Because you can tell who they are. And they work really hard and they'll talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Which turned out to be true. And as it happened, the place where we were living was literally just up the road from a motorcycle taxi stand. So I began working with these motorcyclists, hanging out at this one particular stand, which in the book I call The Junction. And the way this happens, essentially, is that for people who maybe haven't seen these things in action, these motorcycle taxis are 125cc motorcycles. They're really not very powerful. I don't know what the situation is in on your side of the pond, but over here you can drive those bikes without a full driving license. And they're ridden mostly by men, or almost exclusively by men. There are a couple of women who were riding when I was in the field, but literally two in a population of 10,000 odd motorcyclists. They're mostly men. They're mostly quite young. So there are some older people, but overall they're pretty young. And generally speaking, they're not particularly well educated. The people I was talking to were had 6 years primary education, and that was pretty much it. Now, these folks are from a variety of different backgrounds. A lot of them have come from backgrounds in manual work, working on building sites, carrying things in markets. A couple of the people I talked to told me very happily that they used to be thieves or drug dealers or whatever. So they're not elite people by any stretch of the imagination. They're driving these motorcycles, which you can get at one of these stands where they congregate, the various throughout Kigali, which are big and well-known. So they're at the bus station, they're at the big shopping centers, they're at the markets, and also in sort of particular places throughout the city. So this particular junction that I worked at was just a road junction. There's a petrol station, there's some shops, and there happens to be a motorcycle taxi stand there. It's a road head to a road that goes out to the countryside. So you can pick them up there, you can hail them on the street. Lots of people who live in Kigali actually know motorcyclists, and they'll actually call somebody up who they know, a bit more like a minicab or something like that, and get themselves picked up by somebody that they know and trust. And these people then, they'll charge you, while I was in the field, you could pay as little as 100 or 200 Rwandan francs for a short trip, you know, a couple of kilometers. So that's, I don't know what this is in I mean, I can do this in sterling. I mean, it's 10 or 20 P, so I guess that's 30 or 40 cents to go on a trip. Or if I went to the airport, it cost me about 1,500 francs. Now, that money that motorcyclists make, they don't make strictly for them or purely for themselves. Because while I was in the field in 2012, 2013, most of the people I was talking to, they rode these bikes, but they didn't own them themselves. The bikes were owned by other people who were entrepreneurs, mostly very, very small-scale entrepreneurs, who'd purchased either new or secondhand, had purchased motorcycles and made a little bit of money renting those motorcycles out to the young men who actually rode them. And that costs 5,000 francs a day.
Wow.
So whatever else that a motorcyclist has to do, he has to pay 5,000 random francs to his boss every day for the use of the motorcycle. That system is changing. When I was back in the field in 2015, I found many more people who were either owner-operators, they were owning their own bike, or who were involved not in a rental agreement with a boss, but in a credit agreement with a boss.
Hmm.
That was there in 2012, 2013, but it looks like it's becoming more prevalent. I mean, the riders I was talking to were saying that they'd started to do that because the bosses were finding the motorcycles don't last long enough. So they'd rather get the 5,000 francs a day in payment for the motorcycle and they not have to worry about it anymore, rather than take the money and have to sell it later because, you know, later it's broken and it's all full of dust and it doesn't really work anymore. So those systems are very much on the move, which is in itself interesting.
Yeah.
Because this whole system of transport, you know, with these motorcycles in Kigali is all since the genocide. So this is all after the end of the civil war and genocide in 1994. So it's all relatively recent, and it's quite a fluid sort of social situation. And that also applies to the regulation of the sector. So when motorcycles were first being used as taxis in Kigali, riders who remember that time, I mean, they remember it with great fondness because they can make a huge amount of money because there was very, very little in the way of public transport infrastructure immediately after the genocide and the end of the civil war. So riding a motorcycle was a really good way to get money in those days, but also that it was a bit like the Wild West. There was no regulation whatsoever. There was a lot of crime, until relatively recently. At least that's what people say. I mean, I haven't got any way directly of substantiating that, obviously, but city officials that I spoke to, as well as motorcyclists that I spoke to, said it was actually really quite lawless and quite dangerous. Then it started to become relatively organized towards the end of the 1990s, early 2000s. An association of motorcyclists was set up that helped to sort of organize things a bit better. I'm going to stick my neck out here. I'm terrible with dates. But I'm going to say in 2008, the sector was reorganized again at the behest of the government, at the same time that a lot of other areas, the sort of informal economy in Rwanda, were reorganized. Into a system of cooperatives, which allowed much stronger government oversight of what was going on in this sector. So now these motorcyclists, as well as having obligations to their bosses, have other obligations to their cooperatives. They have to pay fees every day. They have to abide by certain rules. They have to wear identifying jackets, which show what cooperative they belong to and have an identifying number. So in principle, the riders can be individually tracked down by the security personnel that the cooperatives run, and also by the police. So they're also, as well as being engaged with these bosses, these riders are also sort of meshed into this sort of quasi-statal system of cooperatives, which sort of operate police functions and security functions and serve to pass down instructions and policy advice and so on from the government and from the police and from the city council. Down to motorcyclists. So that was the kind of context, essentially, that I was working in. I mean, in practical terms, it meant one of two or three things. I would ship up most days at my local motorcycle stand and spend time chatting with the guys who were there, both the riders who were working and also a group of riders who weren't working because they, for one reason or another, didn't have access to a motorbike. Mostly they didn't have these relationships to these entrepreneurs, to these bosses that the other motorcyclists had. So they were waiting for somebody to get tired so they could borrow a motorbike for that 5,000 franc fee. So a motorcyclist will ride his bike for 8 or 10 hours. And when he gets tired, he'll pass it on to somebody else. And that somebody else will pay him the 5,000 francs that he owes to the boss. So these bikes get passed around in quite complicated ways sometimes. And certainly, most of the time, they're on the road 24 hours a day, more or less. So I spent a lot of time talking to the guys who didn't have motorbikes, obviously, because they weren't, you know, they weren't as busy. They had time on their hands. They were just sort of sat in the shade waiting for something to happen, and so were very willing to talk. So a lot of them were quite experienced motorcyclists. I mean, these guys will fall in and fall out of relationships with bosses, especially the ones who have slightly irregular or insecure lives in one way or another. You know, sometimes they're going to be able to maintain that relationship and sometimes they won't. So I spent a lot of time talking with them. And then at other times I went around with my research assistant, who deserves to be front and center, actually, of everything I'm saying. He's absolutely brilliant, facilitating things and helping me to talk to people. So I went around with him and we interviewed people from the cooperatives, the local cooperatives, and people from the city council, the police, and so on, other people who were sort of stakeholders in the motorcycle business. We also talked to a couple of engineers, you know, mechanics, rather. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of the sort of sector and what I did. I mean, you mentioned the story of Jean-Baptiste. He was actually a cooperative leader, who I got involved in, or got involved with. I mean, one of the things which was going on while I was in the field was that there was a sort of sea change going on in the way that the cooperatives were managed and the way that they operated. So I mentioned a bit earlier that around 2008, the organization of motorcyclists, if you like, the sort of civil society, loosely civil society organization of motorcyclists, was rearranged. And it was rearranged from an informal association to a system of cooperatives, which are defined in a particular way in Rwandan law. What happened when that happened was that the branches of the Motorcyclist Association just turned into cooperatives. But what was going on by 2012, 2013, when I was in the field, was a whole lot of new cooperatives were being set up. And these new cooperatives were kind of in competition with the old cooperatives, which were these old branch associations. And Jean-Baptiste was the president of one of these new cooperatives, and he was very aggressive in lots of ways. He set the fee to join his cooperative extremely low, and he was trying to attract all of these riders from other cooperatives to join his new cooperative. Now, there are lots of reasons why he might have been doing that. Obviously, he wanted to make a name for himself, and he was looking for people to connect himself to and to sort of create a following for himself amongst motorcyclists. But also, motorcyclists very often would say that their cooperatives were corrupt, and that people who were in the sort of hierarchy of the cooperatives would take their fees and take fines and take money from them, which in principle should belong to the cooperative and should ultimately go back to the members, but in practice would vanish. And so Jean-Baptiste was quite possibly involved in that kind of activity. And he certainly benefited from it because he gained a lot of members. And when there was a big scandal in the old, well-established cooperative that he was sort of competing with, basically what happened is that the president of the cooperative lit out to South Africa with all of the money and was never seen again. So there was a lot of bad feeling in that cooperative. You know, a great deal of money had gone missing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of those members joined with Jean-Baptiste and with his new cooperative. Now, I mean, this sort of story, I guess, gives you a bit of a sense of quite how cutthroat, in some ways, how dangerous this whole sector is, and this whole, I suppose, in a way, the whole of the informal economy of Kigali, because one way or another, Jean-Baptiste then was making waves amongst the established cooperatives in his bit of Kigali, but also more broadly. And those cooperative leaders had a very strong connection with one of the officials in Kigali City Council, who took a very strong interest in them, and a lot of my motorcyclist friends thought a corrupt interest in what was going on. Of course, none of this, I mean, I'm not making any allegations here, I'm just saying what people said to me. And so what happened to Jean-Baptiste ultimately is that rivals from within the motorcycle sector, along with this official from Kigali City Council, essentially tried to shut him down and tried to install a new cooperative leadership, and he was in prison. He was in prison, but managed to get himself out again quite rapidly. And what his allies told me at the time was that they'd gone to the ruling party, essentially, to the Rwandan Patriotic Front, directly, not through the government, but directly used contact within the party to get Jean-Baptiste released. And he was released and he was reinstated against this, and this official in the city council was reprimanded quite publicly. I mean, it was in the Kinyarwanda newspapers.
Yeah.
That the mayor of Kigali had reprimanded him. It didn't last, unfortunately, for Jean-Baptiste, though. He, well, fortunately or unfortunately, by the time I came back to Rwanda in 2015, he wasn't president of the cooperative anymore, and it looked as though he was probably going back to prison, because what he'd essentially tried to do is he'd tried to argue that a great deal of the cooperative's property actually belonged to him. So it seemed that when he was supported by his staff and the cooperative members, when he was first put into prison, they kind of hoped that some of that stuff would get shared around. But by 2015, it was fairly obvious that he was overplaying his hand, as it were, and trying to get more out of it than anybody was willing to support him to do. And the same people who were saying in 2013 that he was a good guy, he was a victim of terrible injustice.
Right.
Those people were now saying, he was totally corrupt and he had to go to prison and it was a disgrace that he'd ever been president of a cooperative. So it was all quite, cutthroat, the whole business. I mean, it felt sometimes a little bit as if you were mixed up in some, in some sort of mob movie occasionally.
Yeah, the intrigues.
Yeah, really, sort of Game of Thrones stuff.
What does, thank you for all of that. What does Jean-Baptiste's story or what you've learned from your work with Motari teach us about subcultures and the relationship between the culture of the Motari, which is what I understand you to be doing in your book, and, the circulation of power in the way that you described earlier? How can students, listeners understand the concept of culture and the concept of power as you conceptualize it? Through a case study like Jean-Baptiste.
Okay. So I think the first stage to hooking these things together is to think about what changed between when Jean-Baptiste was first in trouble with the authorities and what happened when, in 2015, when he looked like he was going to be in trouble again.
Oh, interesting.
Now, okay. What happened when he was first in trouble with the authorities is that Jean-Baptiste was able to get out of trouble by mobilizing a whole lot of influential people in his defense, right? So he got in touch with, or he didn't personally, but his supporters got in touch with local government. And I know that definitely because I've seen the correspondence that they wrote between themselves and the executive secretary of the local government units that the cooperative operated in. So they got in touch with those people, and also they told me. Now I can't evidence this because this was all done by word of mouth, so I only have what they told me. They also told me they got in touch with the RPF, and I've got no reason to suppose they didn't just go to the head office, which is located in Kigali, and go and actually talk to senior people in the ruling party. So what he was doing was organizing for himself a network of people who would support him. Now, he didn't do that in a vacuum. He had laid the groundwork to be able to do that in his rise to become the president of the cooperative. And he'd done that by, the way I describe it in the book is by aligning himself to the sorts of things that those influential people would like him to say, the sorts of positions that they would like him to take up. So what essentially, if you talk to him, it was very, very, very obvious, especially before he knew me desperately well, is you would have this conversation with him and he would just interject by saying, oh, we had the most amazing government. The government is fantastic and we'll elect the president 100%. He'd say these kinds of things in meetings as well. So in that way, and also in more subtle ways, in the way that he described the cooperative system, in the way that he cultivated his connections and the way that he spoke about them, the sorts of people he tried to connect me to, it was obvious that what he was doing was creating this This network of associations with people who'd potentially be useful. Now, that goes back to what I was talking about at the start, I guess, about the way in which Rwandan people handle truth. And this is something which, I say, comes out very clearly from the scholarship, and this isn't my idea. But the ways in which Rwandan people speak, and when they speak, it's almost inevitably politically, that what's important in a relationship is not what is true, but what the more influential, the situationally more influential interlocutor wants to hear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree.
It's what their position is, what will align with their position. So what he'd done in my reading is he created this network, which meant that when he was in trouble, that network was activated against the resources of this official in Kigali City Council and his allies in the other motorcyclist organizations. And ultimately, that was sufficient to get Jean-Baptiste out of trouble. Enough people thought that his support was worth having, or they were going to get something out of him that he was worth supporting. Now, when he was in trouble again in 2015, though, it was quite obvious to lots of people that actually it wasn't that worth having. But what he was trying to do, I mean, in fact, what he did was he went to court, Jean-Baptiste. He went to court to try and argue that all of the things that he'd stolen from the cooperative, I mean, all of these cooperative presidents essentially have you know, a dubious relationship to what's their property and what's the cooperative's property. And sometimes they put it back, sometimes they don't. But he'd gone to court to try and argue that everything actually belonged to him. And by doing that, what he'd essentially done was to cut that network off, right? If this stuff just belonged to him, then nobody had any interest any longer in supporting him because none of it was going to flow down this network. His support wasn't worth having. He wasn't a useful person to be in touch with. And his support totally melted away. So he was in serious trouble. Now, I think that's telling you about theories of power. There's two things, I think, that I take from that. The first one is that to understand how people are manipulating these relationships, which are to do with control, which are to do with, in one way or another, with force, right? I mean, mm-hmm. who gets to prevail in particular situations, are very much modeled on the way they're handling language, the way they're handling their social relations, the way they imagine their plans and things playing out in relation to others. In other words, they're founded on the way they imagine themselves as persons, right, operating in the world. So that's the first thing, I think, that I would take from that. And the second one is that ideas about resistance and power work relatively poorly in relation to this story. And this, again, isn't an idea that I can lay any particular claim to. And Nicola Palmer also makes the same kind of argument, is that what's going on is a crossing, if you like, between people who are in relatively weak social positions or relatively low hierarchical positions. I mean, the way my Rwandan friends would describe it was they were on a low level.
Right, low people.
There's a crossing between those low people and high people, because the low people are mobilizing the high people, just as the high people in turn will mobilize them. So the exercise of power and the exercise of resistance actually look very much the same. It's just a question of where in that network you're looking at any given time, right? I mean, you can say that Jean-Baptiste is a kind of subaltern character in some ways, right? He's not really a very powerful person. I mean, he's a sort of two-bit businessman in some ways. Right. So in some ways, it looks as though he should be a sort of resistant character. But at the same time, what he's doing is not really of a different kind to what people on the other side were doing when they were mobilizing this official in Kigali City Council for their purposes. So what you've got then is this sort of situation where if you read it like that, and I say you don't have to by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that reading is available. If you read it like that, it complicates where you think power and resistance might lie in any of these social situations.
I think that's for me, as someone who also has worked on Rwanda, is the value of your book, because you show us, number one, the importance of these kind of networks. The culture of a network like the Motari subculture, let's call it, and then the way that individuals who have a certain economic standing in society are able to jockey, I guess. I'm not sure I have the right word available at this minute, but It is a two-sided coin in the way that you describe. Sometimes you're, you know, an underling, a low person, and other times you're a high person or a person of prestige or status. I thought that was the real clever turn in your work. I thought your work was really important for that reason. And of course, we're beginning to run out of time, so I don't want to keep you much longer. You've been so generous with your ideas and your time. Can you tell us just sort of as we begin to wrap up about the cover art? How did you choose it? What do you intend to convey with the cover? You have a fascinating cover. I would urge listeners to go to the website and take a look of a street in Kigali, motorcycles, UN-type 4x4s, pedestrians, and you kind of stylized it. I don't know if it's a piece of art or it's if it's a sepia-toned photograph.
It's actually underneath there somewhere. It's a photograph, when I was publishing the book, I mean, Lexington very generously gave me access to lots of stock images. But for one reason or another, while I think that actually visually motorcyclists are quite compelling, people who take photographs of motorcycles in Rwanda always seem to want to do it upcountry in rural areas, which I suppose looks more African-y and more, I don't know why they do it. But anyway, there weren't really any appropriate images. So I had to use one of my own, which is what this is. It's a photograph that I took on a mobile phone, actually. It's stylized principally to keep it safe.
Makes sense.
So it's been through a large number of filters to make something which I thought looked like a half-decent image. But because of the faces and number plates.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful image. It's a really stunning image.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's nice. But, I mean, it was really, that was the reason it got stylized. I mean, you know, I've got a lot of photographs. But because of the kind of political context that Rwanda is, I absolutely didn't want to have any number plates or anything identifiable in the image, which is why it got done like that.
Is that also why you don't have any pictures or photographs of your interlocutors in the book?
Yeah, that is why. Again, I took a lot of photographs, which was a great way of getting to know people, and you're able to then give them prints and so on. Or yes, it was actually before many of them could deal with it digitally, I suppose. It was just on the cusp. Yeah, you could give them prints and so on, and people enjoyed having their photographs taken. But at the end of the day, I just thought it wasn't worth the risk of exposing people.
It's an interesting observation, having just heard you speak about Jean-Baptiste. You can be free to move, so to speak, in one context and sanctioned and accused of corruption in another context. But Will, I want to, thank you for your time. I just want to ask one more question. I always like my listeners to know, number one, what you're working on now. And if sub-question, what novels or books or anything, what would you recommend about Rwanda or your current project or whatever sort of for future reading you might offer to the listener?
Oh, goodness. What am I working on now? Well, to be absolutely honest, I've spent the last, how long is it now, in lockdown, homeschooling two kids.
120 days, yeah.
Over the past, I don't know how long, I felt really lucky if I got 90 minutes of work done a day. What am I working on now? Well, the next thing I think that I'm interested on is thinking about the pandemic. There are two things I'm interested in. One of them is modeling, especially the relationship between conventional epidemic modeling and these new dynamic forms of modeling associated with this neuroscientist Carl Friston, which are capable of digesting uncertainty and that ask questions about the nature of modernity in interesting ways, which dovetail actually with the final chapter of the book and what I have to say about thinking about the world otherwise.
Yes.
In the final chapter of the book. So that's one thing I'm interested in. The other thing that I'm interested in is compliance. This book is very much about compliance and the ways in which people imagine and comply with government demands, which I think probably has something to say with the way that people have handled lockdown. as a kind of event which has required massive compliance. So those are two things I'm interested in at the moment. Things that people can read. Well, I mean, obviously they should read your 2018 book, which is a great introduction to Rwanda and Rwandan politics, and very, very, very accessible, and which I enjoyed greatly. The other things which I've read and really enjoyed, Andrea Perdikova's Making of Bumle is a great book.
It is a great book.
Enjoyed that book. I mean, it's so interesting and so, it's horrifying in lots of ways. And the other book, which I've got a huge amount out of, and it's totally, in a way, off topic from my point of view, though I do make a lot of use of it in the book, is Scott Strauss's Order of Genocide, which I think is really a sort of social scientific tour de force in lots of ways. A really, really, really good book.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. I mean, I also would continue to recommend J.J. Mackay's Premise of Inequality, which, while it gets very, very bad press, is in lots of ways remains extremely interesting. I mean, it's a very problematic book in all sorts of ways, terribly, terribly problematic, and reveals all sorts of issues about, in some ways, how you shouldn't do research in Rwanda. But at the same time, there are so many continuities between what he's saying back in the day and the sorts of things that Strauss and Perdikova and myself, I think, are saying.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to end. Will, I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for your insights. And just thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.